Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Nice to see so many people here on a Sunday morning, especially when there's British Premiership football on at the same time. Revisiting the religion-science conflict. Okay. The word revisiting here is very important. There has long been, purportedly, a religion-science conflict. Okay? And the most obvious form of that conflict would be, you know, exhibited by the story of the child who goes to his mother and says, "Mummy, how is it that human beings came to be upon the earth?" And she says, "Well, you know, Hashem created the world and he created everything, kind of, you know, heaven and earth and the seas and vegetation and plants, animals. And then on the sixth day, he created Adam and Chava. And then you have human beings, and that's how human beings came about." And he says, "Okay, very interesting." And then he goes to Daddy. He says, "Daddy, how did human beings come about? How did it come to be that there are human beings on the earth?" And he said that, "Well, billions of years ago, there was this primeval soup, and out of that eventually evolved these living organisms, amongst which were apes, there were monkeys. And over millions of years, we human beings evolved out of the monkeys." So you've got a conflict. He goes back to Mummy. He says, "Mummy, you told me that Hashem created human beings a few thousand years ago with Adam and Eve. And Daddy told me that we evolved over millions of years out of monkeys." And Mummy says, "Yes, he's talking about his side of the family." So that is not the conflict about which we are speaking. Okay? Things have moved on somewhat since then, all right? And there are many, many people who have written kind of something along these lines, but the first very brief source there from Rav Soloveitchik, from the Halachic Mind. And he says the following. He says, "When we speak of a conflict existing between philosophy and science, we do not have in mind a controversy concerning scientific data, which philosophy would interpret in a manner alien to science. Modern philosophy neither pretends omniscience nor countenances the audacity to doubt in the least the validity of scientific statements." Okay, very important. For Rav Soloveitchik, who is not our main subject today, but nonetheless who shares this view with Rav Kook, for Rav Soloveitchik, when we talk today about a religion-science conflict, or even a philosophy-science conflict, we're not talking about that old version of the conflict. Yeah, he's saying here philosophy does not have the audacity to doubt the validity of scientific statements. Okay? Science does science. Very important. And what it tells us is kind of, you know, true, scientifically speaking. Okay? I mean, not absolutely true. Nothing is. Any good scientist will admit that scientists are fallible and things will change and we might not have the whole truth. But for these thinkers, Rav Kook amongst them, okay, science tells us the truth about science, and the Torah, even if it might literally appear to be in contradiction with what the scientists tell us, it's not. Okay, but what's interesting, and what that initially, are two different ways of saying there is no such conflict, and that will actually lead us into our main religion-science conflict, which is a completely different one. Okay, so what we're going to be doing today is laying out the contemporary religion-science conflict, which has very little or almost nothing to do with that initial conflict about, oh, science, you know, evolution against kind of Maaseh Bereishit, what do we do? Yeah, that's not a conflict. Okay? Science is fine. Says Rav Soloveitchik, we don't have the audacity to question science. Okay? It's something, I mean, some people do. All right? There are people who say, no, if the Torah says what it says, it means it literally, and therefore scientists are wrong. Okay, there are people who say that. I have to admit, it's not kind of a view I take, and it's one that, of all views, I'm slightly intolerant of, because I find it problematic. There are many, many things that we all rely on, that we all use every single day, that relies ultimately somewhere along the line on those scientific conclusions. So, you know, if you want to use your GPS, or you want to use your transistor, or lasers, or MRIs, then it's going to be very difficult to dispute some of those scientific kind of, you know, basics upon which a lot of that is based. It's kind of like, you know, the people who these people who are opposed to Israel boycotts. Yeah, so they'll boycott Israel, but obviously not the cancer treatments. Yeah, it's kind of similar, it's intellectually dishonest. Or kind of, there's a problem of intellectual integrity there. So that's not our religion-science conflict. Okay? We're going to say, you know, science, fine. We'll study science. Which leaves us with a question. And the question that arises out of this would be the first question. Okay, so what is Marcel Breschet about if it's not teaching you that kind of science? Okay, and have a look at the first quote from Ralph Cook. So number two here from some famous letters of his from... He wrote a number of letters to Moshe Seidel, which kind of are concerned with science. Okay? And these are just a couple of excerpts from them. First one that's interesting. Number two there, Torah Vadai Sadma B'Maaseh Bereishit. Yeah? Torah obviously, you know, kind of, you know, tried to hide the meaning of Maaseh Bereishit. Yeah? V'dibra B'Remizot U'Mashalim, spoke in hints and mashalim, yeah, spoke in parables. Sharia Koli Yodim Shemaaseh Bereishit Hemiklal Sitrei Torah. Everybody knows, yeah, Chagiga. Yeah, second parak Chagiga. Maaseh Bereishit is one of those secrets of the Torah. Okay? V'imayu kol advarim rak pshutam eze seita yeshkan. Yeah, if everything was meant literally, what's the secret? Okay, the very fact that Maaseh Bereishit's a secret kind of indicates immediately you're not meant to take it literally, no? Okay? If it's literal, then there's no secret there. So it's not one of the Sitrei Torah. Okay, so that's kind of Rav Cook's starting point. Ukvar Meruba Medrash, and kind of he gives us a Midrash here. Lagid Kach Maaseh Bereishit Lebasar Badam Eifshar. Yeah, you can't actually really exhibit the power of Maaseh Bereishit to, you know, us flesh and blood creatures. Lefichach Satama Katuv Bereishit Bara Elokim. And that's why. Kind of that initial pasuk, yeah, Bereishit Bara Elokim, it's kind of, it's hidden, it's sealed, it's kind of, you know, dealing with secrets. So what is it dealing with instead? He says, V'ha ikar hi, hayadiyah ha'ole mikol ha'inyan ladat Hashem, v'chaye ha'musaha amiti. Okay, what's the actual ikar here? It's kind of, you know, it's what knowledge we can get out of this about dat Hashem and chaye musaha amiti, about true morality and knowledge of God. Okay, that's what this is actually dealing with, all right, according to Rav Cook. It's interesting just at the end here, I mean, it's worth seeing how he ends off. Yeah, so number one, he's saying, which is very important, yeah, Maaseh Bereishit isn't trying to teach you science at all, okay? There are those who would say that Maaseh Bereishit, the opening, you know, Prakim, are trying to teach you science. They're not doing it literally. And therefore, but if you look deeply and look at kind of, you know, the hidden meaning, you'll actually find it's talking about contemporary science. So there are books, kind of famous books by Natan Aviezer, Gerald Schroeder, who try and, you know, make the case that Bereishit does teach you science if you don't take it literally. Okay, actually, kind of, what if I can just talk about the Ramban, and actually, kind of, you know, Gerald Schroeder uses Ramban a lot in order to try and make this type of case. But what Rav Cook's saying here is different. He's saying that it's not actually teaching you science at all. Okay, it's not that here's science, but in a non-literal sense. It's actually saying, no, it's teaching you other stuff. Yeah, Maaseh Bereishit is not about how the world was created. That's not the story it's telling you. It's teaching us stuff about Dat Hashem, yeah, knowledge of God, which, you know, admittedly some people would say, well, science is part of knowledge of God, so maybe it is teaching science. You know, one could say that. And chaye hamusaha amiti, okay? That's actually what we're supposed to draw out of this, all right? And God wrote it this way. If he just goes on just to the end of that, v'kadosh baruch hu notem b'mishkal afil haruach shechal al hanaviim. And you know that God kind of, you know, measured out, so to speak. Yeah, he quantified exactly how it is that the Spirit should fall on the Nevi'im such that Hutsimsem Shadavka Kishayichnasu Hadvarim Hagdolim Sheba Elehainyanim Be Elehatsiorim Yuchlu Ben Adam Lishov Mehem Im Kolishtadlutam Et Kol Hayote Mo'ol V'Nisgavlaya. Okay? He did it in this way, put it in these particular parables, in order, because, you know, God knows the kinds of things that you would be able to get out of this stuff. So it was very carefully worded so that you would get the right things out of it. Okay, it's actually very interesting. When people do, you do occasionally get people who still criticize and say, well, obviously the Torah's nonsense. And the reason the Torah's nonsense is because, look, it tells you the world was created in 6 days, and we all know that's not true. Okay, that's a critique that you still get from some of the kind of more radical atheists that are around, your Richard Dawkins, whoever it might be. Okay, and when you think about it, it's actually a really, really stupid criticism. Okay, it's actually a really, really stupid critique to launch. Because if you have a book written thousands of years ago, okay, even if the author of that book, in this case God, knows quantum mechanics, he's not going to write it in a book, because nobody's going to understand what on earth he's talking about. They haven't come across electricity yet alone quantum mechanics. So it's obvious to Rav Kook what he's saying here. Yeah, he had to give the Nevi'im the Ruach to understand, to write things in such a way that they would be open to later interpretation. Because right then, it would have been impossible to write a book that anybody would have understood or taken seriously that would have started off with Big Bang, quantum mechanics, etc. So to criticize and say, oh look, the Torah does, of course it doesn't. Even if you knew it then, you wouldn't write it. You'd have to write things in such a way that they could be understood then and understood now differently to the way they were understood then. And that's what's going on. Okay. But as I say, the most important, probably most interesting element of this is the idea that according to Rav Kook, what we're meant to get out of Maaseh Bereishit is Da'at Hashem and Chayei Musari Amiti. Okay? Not science. Not science. So there are three approaches. Number one, the Torah is meant to be taken literally and science is bunk. Okay? It's an approach I personally don't like. It's an approach. It's an approach that has legitimately been taken by kind of, you know, various people within kind of Orthodox communities. So you can't dismiss it, but, you know, it's not an approach that in any way speaks to me. There's a second approach, which is to say, the Torah teaches us science, but it does so in a veiled way. Okay? Which is, again, a legitimate approach. Okay? Taken by many. However, there is a third approach, which appears to be this approach, which says, it wasn't trying to do that in the first place. Okay? You want to do science, go study science. Okay? You want to be a nuclear physicist, don't study Tanakh, go study nuclear physics. But if you want to know about Da'at Hashem and the right way, then you learn this. Because Maaseh Bereishit, actually, the real kind of secrets here are those, not scientific secrets. Okay, that appears to be the view that Rav Kook is here taking. Okay, pretty definitely also the view that Rav Soloveitchik takes. Okay, sorry, you have been waiting. Yes, there's no worry.
It's just, it seems strange that for something so important, source of the book is Hare HaKol Yodim.
Right. Yeah. I get fair. All right. The truth is that
that's Sitrei Torah, kind of, there
in the Mishnah from the beginning. Yeah, 100%. That much is true. Whether that's kind of the Hare HaKol Yodim that he's referring to, I'm not sure. It's slightly you're right, it's kind of, you know, as a way of putting things, it might be seen as a little bit too dismissive of something that's quite so important. But you certainly, there's no question, there are sources that abound, yeah, that indicate this type of view. Yeah, and given who he's writing to, the Hare Kol Yodim would be kind of, you know, your type of kol. As in, look, you guys know this stuff, so, yeah. Now, it does leave us with a problem, by the way. Okay, and this problem will get us into the real religion-science conflict. Because the obvious problem this yields is that if you're not going to take Maaseh Bereishit literally, if you're not going to take it literally, then, well, where do you stop? Okay? As in, there are plenty of parts of Tanakh, yeah, that would seem to be problematic from a scientific perspective. Okay? So what? We're meant to reinterpret. How much are we meant to take literally? How much are we not meant to take literally? Okay, this does kind of open up kind of Pandora's box. There's a problem here. Because then, you know, somebody come along, oh, we don't take this literally, don't take that literally. Okay, famously. Okay, you know, the Rambam, Maimonides, all right, was taken on by some of his followers, because the Rambam very clearly allegorized all kinds of descriptions of God, for example. And then, you know, what did that lead to down the line, a couple of generations? Certain people say, well, we can allegorize mitzvot as well then, can't we? And so, you know, it's a slippery slope. Okay, it's a slippery slope. And Rav Kook does address this. He addresses it, albeit briefly.
Wish to advance the argument that everything is hidden and mystery.
Yeah.
That's one thing. But when the Torah says 6 days,
mm-hmm.
that's very specific. It's almost the same as saying 40 years. Well, who knows if 40 years is really 40 years?
100%. No, 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 but that's exactly the problem. I mean, that, so that's the question. The question is, once you start doing this, where do you stop? Yeah? You're right. This is a chat. This is a problem.
The secrets of creation are mysterious, and Hashem did not want to talk to us about quantum mechanics.
Right, right, right.
If he took the step, perhaps the unnecessary step, of saying 6 days, he did that for a reason, because it's superfluous otherwise. 100%. So what's the reason?
Okay. 100%. Very good question. Okay. So the fact is that what this approach does is it opens up that question. What it means is there is now a vacuum such that you need to go back to the text and you say, okay, so what is it teaching us? Okay, 100%. Okay, but more than that, in terms of the judgment question, the criteria, just have a look, just a one-liner from another of the letters, also to Moshe Seidel, where he says the following at the bottom there, number 3. Vim ein kol yachid yachol atziv gvul meduyak. Yeah, so, you know, if it's not possible for every individual to give a precise dividing point between, well, what's meant to be literal and what's a mashal, yeah, he says, Bahachush habahir shel ha'uma bichlala umotzei lo et nativotav lo barayot bododot ki im betviot ayin klalit. Okay, we're basically saying, you know what, there isn't some rational algorithm for this. Okay? It's not that you're going to give individual proofs, okay, rayot bododot, you give, well, this one or this one, yeah? There's something a little less purely rational about this decision procedure. Okay? It's something that, I mean, in the translation, which is there, kind of, I put it as a general intuition, tviotayin, okay, kind of perceptual. Yeah, something kind of perceptual about it, intuition, but it's not rational. So he admits that what is and is not literal, it's not as if you're going to actually have some scientific algorithm to distinguish. Okay? This is something that is given more to intuition, and obviously, kind of almost goes without saying, but later on it's said, you know, it's not anybody's intuition. Yeah? Not anybody just can look, well, I think. Yeah? It's got to be somebody steeped in our text. It's got to be somebody, one of the, as he calls them, tzaddikim. Yeah? Who will be able to know these things and tell you, well, which one is and which one's not? But it does open up that question. All right? And more specifically for Maaseh Bereishit, okay, so how do we interpret these texts? But again, that's not my problem. Okay? That's not what we're dealing with today. Because what we're dealing with emerges out of this thing he says at the end regarding how are we to decide these things? Okay, how do we decide what's literal and what's not? And he says there, it's not rayot bododot, it's not specific proofs. Okay, there's something more general, a more general type of perception or intuition given to certain people that allows them to make these distinctions. Okay? I mean, the truth of Maaseh Bereishit is not difficult because it's kind of there right from the beginning. Yeah, as one of the Sitrei Torah. Yeah, Maaseh Bereishit, Maaseh Merkavah, these things are, you know, stated in the Mishnah that these things are seen. So to take them non-literally, frankly, you can point to a source that says these are secrets. It's not really a problem. Okay, but for other things you can see, people might say, well, where do you draw the line? And what's interesting, and the thing here that really is the central thing I want to kind of get across today, is this idea the way to know things, the way to know some of the most important things about Torah and what it means, isn't to do with rational proof. Okay? Now I say that standing here as a philosopher. Okay? So don't tell anybody because I'll be out of a job. Alright? But the way I want to get there is actually deeply philosophical. Okay? I mean, not too deeply. People get scared sometimes by the word philosophy. And hopefully it will be totally understandable to all. But the real conflict here has nothing to do with content. Okay, it's not about content. Right, content, you can always ask the question, well, does the Torah really teach us this? Is it literal? Is it not? Maybe it does mean kind of, you know, eons of time. Who knows? Okay? Content you can play with. The most important thing here is much more to do with method. Okay? Because what is the scientific method? More importantly, what is a scientist's approach to knowledge? What is it to know something? And for a long time, in the modern era, goes back to a thinker called Descartes. This was the view of how it is we come to know things. Okay? I am a subject. The world out there is my object. Okay? Now, for me to know that world out there, that object, I need to remove all of my prejudices. Yeah? I need to remove any kind of subjective aspects that I'm bringing to the table. I need to just record what's out there anyway. Yeah? Okay? Can't be subjective. Has to be objective. And objective means I have to get rid of all my personal interests here and just look at the world as it is. Okay? That's the key to scientific knowledge. Alright? Clear away all of your own interests to just record what's out there. Okay? Your own tastes can't determine things. Okay? So, you know, we have bar of chocolate on the table, okay? I taste it, I say it's disgusting, you taste it, you say it's delicious, okay? And I, you know, can I claim objectively it is disgusting or objectively it is delicious? And that's just the way, no, it's a matter of taste, yeah? Science can't be a matter of taste like that, surely. Yeah? I mean, science is just true. And if it's just true, it can't be a matter of taste. It can't depend on my own particular beliefs. All right? Comes up the question, you know, can you do Jewish science? Okay? Einstein was Jewish, did science. Was it Jewish science? No. Yeah, it applies to everybody. It doesn't matter what religion they are, where they live, who they are, when they... Yeah, it's true. And it's true because it's got nothing to do with him. Yeah? He was the genius who recognized it, but it's out there, waiting, and we just pick it up. Okay? That is the view of, you know, how do we get knowledge? Rather than just matters of taste. We get knowledge through pure reason. Get rid of the will. Get rid of your own desires, your own passions. Pure reason. Record what's out there. That's what we do. Okay? And that's the scientific method. That's how scientists would advise back then that we gain knowledge. Okay? Clear? That is the seat of the religion-science conflict that I want to address. Because Rav Kook, among others, okay, again, Rav Soloveitchik is kind of there here too, they both question that model of knowledge. Okay, the idea that knowledge means getting rid of all your interests and just seeing what's there anyway. But that is the way to know things, is something they question. Okay? And actually, before we get into Rav Kook, it is worth looking at a brief quote from a, admittedly, non-Jewish, but not anti-Jewish, despite popular thought on this, German philosopher called Friedrich Nietzsche. Okay? Nietzsche, I believe he's called in these parts, but Nietzsche. Okay? Nietzsche questioned this idea that knowledge is about getting rid of all your interests. Okay, question that idea. And he questioned it in a way that is taken up very strongly by thinkers like Rav Kook. Okay, the extent to which they were, you know, doing it because they'd read Nietzsche, because Nietzsche had done it, is, you know, open to question. There are those who think that Rav Kook certainly was very, very enamored of Nietzsche's thought, of elements of Nietzsche's thought. Various scholars have written that, you know, certainly Nietzsche is playing in here to what Rav Kook is doing. But I'm not interested in making that historical claim. Okay? All I'm interested in here is the idea. Okay, Nietzsche has an idea, and I think that same idea we find in Rav Kook. Okay? With one very, very, very important difference. Okay? Let's have a look first at the idea. Okay? We're going to question this idea of what knowledge is. Nietzsche on the genealogy of morals says the following. Objectivity. The latter understood not as contemplation without interest, which is a nonsensical absurdity, but as the ability to control one's pro and con, and to dispose of them so that one knows how to employ a variety of perspectives and effective interpretations in the service of knowledge. Okay, what's that opening line mean? It says objectivity is not contemplation without interest. That doesn't make sense. The idea of knowing something and getting rid of all your interests and just knowing things as they are to him, that's absurd. It makes no sense. Okay? And instead, knowledge is about controlling one's, as he puts it, pro and con. Pro and con here meaning desire, basically, your will. Yeah, you're pro something, yeah, for it or against it. And it's the ability to control your for and your against that he thinks is really at the seat of knowledge. Okay, we'll go on with the quote further and then explain what this means exactly. Okay, but let's just push on a little further. Henceforth, my dear philosophers, fourth line of the Nietzsche quote, let us be on guard against the dangerous old conceptual fiction that posited a pure, willless, painless, timeless knowing subject. Let us guard against the snares of such contradictory concepts as pure reason, absolute spirituality, knowledge in itself. These always demand that we should think of an I that is completely unthinkable, an I turned in no particular direction, in which the active and interpreting forces through which alone seeing becomes seeing something are supposed to be lacking. These always demand of the eye an absurdity and a nonsense. There is only a perspective seeing, only a perspective knowing. And the more affects we allow to speak about one thing, the more eyes, more different eyes we can use to observe one thing, the more complete will our concept of this thing or objectivity be. But to eliminate the will altogether, to suspend each and every affect, affect being the affects, the wills, the passions. Supposing we were even capable of this, what would that mean but to castrate the intellect? What's he saying here? Gives us a nice analogy that makes it quite clear, but which is vision, eyes. Okay, every one of you now, okay, you're looking in a certain direction, and you're looking in that direction from a certain place. And therefore, not one of you shares the same perspective. Okay? All of you are looking from your particular place, and that gives you your perspective. Okay? And that's the very definition of seeing. Okay? That doesn't mean you're not seeing it properly. That's just what seeing is. Yeah? It's not possible. It's absurd. It's a nonsensical absurdity, as he puts it, to think of an eye that sees from nowhere. What does that mean? Okay, it's nonsense. You can't have an eye that sees from nowhere. Okay? I mean, at best, you know, that's kind of how we understand, you know, kivyachol, what's going on with God, maybe. Yeah, but as human beings, all right, the eye that sees from nowhere, it's nonsense. We all see from a certain perspective. Okay? Now, it's true, you put all those perspectives together, you can get a much better vision of the whole. Okay? So if, you know, if I see something, yeah, for all you know, standing there, somebody, I might just be a two-dimensional figure. Okay? So you have a walk around, okay? All right, I'm actually not, okay? But, you know, now you know that. It wasn't, I'm sure it didn't come as a shock. But you know, you have to kind of get all the perspectives in order to know that, right? Nietzsche's arguing that knowledge, despite what people might think, is exactly the same. There is no such thing as knowledge that is uninformed by interests. All knowledge is interested. All knowledge is from a perspective. Let me give you a simple example. Okay? Imagine I wanted to go climbing in the highlands of Scotland. Okay? I want to go climbing. So I get a map. And what do I want on that map? I want that map to give me the topography. I want to know how steep the mountains are, and that's what I want to know. Okay? Imagine that I'm going on a driving holiday through the highlands of Scotland. Then I want a map that shows me all the roads. Okay? Which of those maps is right? Both. And it all depends on your interest. It all depends on what it is you want. If you want to go driving, you need a roadmap, and that roadmap is true. If you want to go climbing, that roadmap's going to be pretty useless. But if I want to go climbing, I get a climbing map. And that map is true. They're both true. But they both answer to different needs, to different perspectives. Okay? Now, the argument that Nietzsche's putting forward here is that is the case for knowledge. All knowledge. There is no such thing as disinterested knowledge, even scientific. Okay? All right, scientific knowledge. You have certain aims when you're doing science. You have certain interests when you're doing science. Okay? If I want to know the science of color vision, for example, then I have a certain interest and I will use my abilities to understand colours with that interest in mind. But if I'm an artist, I have no interest whatsoever in the wavelengths that are being reflected off the surface. I'm interested in the way the colours mix together in a more basic surface sense. That's what I'm interested in, because I'm an artist, I'm not a scientist. Okay? But again, each of those are legitimate things to be doing. But in each case, you need to be doing the thing in the service of your interest. Okay? All right? A perfect example of this that you find in both in Rav Kook and in, again, Rav Soloveitchik when they talk about tshuva. Okay? Can you change the past? Obviously, you can't change the past. We all know you can't change the past. But when they're writing about tshuva, you can change the past. What are they doing there? They're not contradicting science. They're not saying that if you're in a laboratory and the experiment doesn't come out the way you want it to, just go back in time and do it again. That's not what they're suggesting. But what they're saying is when you're in shul, you know, when it's the asarit you made tshuva, and when you're thinking about it, then you apply a perspective on time that isn't scientific and isn't meant to be, but is religious and psychological and incredibly important when what you're engaged in is a religious psychological set of actions. You've got two concepts of time. They contradict each other, but they're both legitimate as long as they don't try and cross over their boundaries. Okay? Is that clear, people? Yeah? So knowledge is always interesting. And here's the religion-science conflict. The religion-science conflict comes about when science believes that it is the only form of knowledge. That if you want to know something, you have to do this disinterest, get rid of all your interests, and that's how to know things. And if you claim that's the only way to know things, then there's a lot of stuff you're never going to know. Because all you'll ever know is science. And you'll never know anything else. Because if you make illegitimate any other pursuit that does not utilize this particular scientific method, then that's where the trouble starts. And again, it's important, this isn't the original religion-science conflict, as I said. Okay? Rav Kook does not think you can change the past as a scientist, but you can as a religious person doing tshuva. These two different things. Okay? We all do this. We all make these separations. I mean, Lahavdil Elef Havdalot, but you know, if a Catholic goes into a store, yeah, and says, I have 3 bars of chocolate there, and he's charged for 3 bars of chocolate, I don't know any Catholic who would say, oh, no, 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 3 is 1, and therefore you only charge me for 1 bar of chocolate. Yeah? But theologically, when they're thinking theologically, they would make that. But they're not kind of, you know, crass and stupid and going to apply it in business. So we all do this. We all make these jumps. We all move in these different perspectives. And the point is, how and if you can combine. Okay? Let's have a look at Rav Kook. First point, most important point, is that it's very clear to me that Rav Kook shares this notion of knowledge. Okay? If you have a look at this from Orot HaKodesh, where he says, if we can go from the beginning of the quote number 5 here, okay? But Surah HaShlema Sheba Achdut Ha'ora HaNishmatit Mitgale ha'or ha'yichudi shel ha'seichel v'haratzon bichlalo. V'chol ha'nekudot ha'ratzoniot mitachdot b'ha'nekudot ha'sichliot. Okay, what is he saying there? Yeah, that kind of, you know, the most perfect kind of form of unity. Yeah, that's the ora ha'nishmatit. Okay, kind of, you know, the enlightened soul, the light of the soul. What is it revealing? The or ha'yichudi shel ha'seichel v'haratzot. Intellect and will. Yes, intellect and will together. It's not intellect. Intellect doesn't give you the highest form of knowledge. It's seichel and ratzon. Yevachol ha'nekudot ha'ratzoniyot mitachdot ha'nekudot ha'sichliyot. Yeah? All these points of will, all these affects have to be. Yeah, there has to be this achdut between the will and the seichel if we are to get to the highest forms of knowledge. Klalot ha-seichel mitached b'klalot ha-ratzon. Yeah? The principles of seichel have to be unified with the principles of will. U'shnehem me'irim b'or echad u'myuchad m'lokoach u'gvora m'lokedusha v'hod m'lotfred u'malchut. Plenty of references there to various sphirot, you see. Yeah? But his point is that the two of them have to be together. They have to be unified if we are to actually reveal kind of the truth or truths. Okay? That's absolutely central if we're to understand kind of the highest truth. So what is he saying? He's saying, yeah, knowledge isn't about seichel. Knowledge is about seichel and ratzon. Okay, that's what it's about, and that's exactly Nietzsche's point. Okay, you can't have knowledge that is purely seichel. You can only have knowledge that combines seichel and ratzon, and at that point you have various different types of knowledge depending on the particular combination of seichel and ratzon. Okay, depending on, okay, what is your interest here? What is it you're aiming at? What is the telos? What is the aim? And what constitutes knowledge is in accordance with that aim. And it's when scientists disallow such a view. It's when scientists say, no, there is one truth. It's scientific and everything else is not. That's the problem. Okay, the problem isn't that scientists give us knowledge that occasionally appears to contradict the literal sense of Torah. That's not a problem. Okay? Then we look and we see, is it good science? If it's good science, then maybe the Torah is not literal, fine. Okay? The problem is when you have the approach that pure science and pure scientific knowledge that is disinterested is the only form of knowledge. Because then you have all kinds of things that you're going to miss. Most important of all, you will obviously miss relationships with God. Okay? And again, we can actually think about this incredibly prosaically. Okay, to begin with, you can think about this in an incredibly mundane sense. Okay, I mean, it's actually not that mundane. Right? Think about your loved ones. Okay? Think about your loved ones. Hey, wives, kids. Now, my wife. Okay? I love my wife dearly. If I think purely rationally, okay, then I calculate, is my wife the most beautiful woman in the entire universe? Okay? All right? Obviously the answer is yes, but, you know, rationally speaking, it's unlikely. Yeah? Is she the most brilliant intellect in the universe? Yeah? So rationally, should I be with somebody else? Should I work? When we relate to people, when we love people, when we have any relationship, you don't deal with it from the pure perspective of theta. Okay? That way is the way to end all relationships. Okay? Relationships are deeply personal. Relationships bring in all kinds of affects. It's not just about seichel, it's about seichel, ratzon, and all kinds of other things. And only in that way will you have a relationship. And if Judaism is in part about a relationship with God, why would we think it's any different? Why would we think that through some purely quasi-scientific intellectual endeavor, I will be able to forge a relationship with God any more than I could with a human being? Okay? If we are scientific to that extent, methodologically, science is the only route to any valuable and worthwhile, yeah, that way lies the ruin of human civilization, genuinely. Okay? Which, as I say, is not to dispute science. Science is fantastic. It's just one of the fantastic things that we are given to understand as human beings. Not the only one, not the exclusive one. And to approach things always as scientists would lead very obviously to the ruin of religion, but not just to the ruin of religion, to the ruin of family, to the ruin of all kinds of things. And that's kind of obvious, actually. Yeah, it shouldn't surprise us. Okay, and therefore it shouldn't surprise us when certain dyed-in-the-wool scientists are very keen to deny religion. Because it's very obvious that if you are the type of scientist, and they are, not all are, but if you are the type who believes this is the only route to knowledge, then you've cut yourself off from the very possibility of knowing anything else than self. Okay, it's the Ratzon and the Seichel together. And Rav Kook, interesting, kind of, and this is kind of the big difference, I guess, between Rav Kook and Nietzsche. Have a look at number 6, Megamat HaYichudim. Talking here about, kind of, you know, dispute, whether it be religious dispute or whatever type of dispute, he says, Kol amigra'ot ha-chomriot ba-ruchaniot, whether it's kind of material, spiritual, sheba olam, ha-kol ba-mipnei she-kol prat me-sig sad echad me-ha-metziot, ha-gashmi ba-ruchani, ha-tov ba-einav, ve-yete ha-stadim she-hem biltim usagim lo, he-nam ba-ador ro'yim lehiot avudim min ha-olam. Yeah? All the problems, kind of, all the problems that we come across, whether physical or spiritual, in the world, all of them come because we are interested in, or we seek, one particular sad, as he puts it here, dimension of reality. Yeah? Whether that be material, whether that be spiritual. The one that hatov be'enav. Yeah? The one that matters to us. Right? And the other ones couldn't care less about, might as well be not exist. Therefore, we're always partial. We're always taking a partial perspective, and we're not interested in the others. And what that means is that and what that leads to is, whether at an individual level or a communal level, that various, as he puts it there, you know, through the generations, okay? that anything that's outside of my particular sphere of interest is kind of, you know, gone. Destruction. Mitoch kacha sibuchim mitgadlim. And it's through that that our confusion abounds and grows, bedeot ve'emunot, b'shutot ha'chayim v'orchot ha'tziburiyot. Okay, it's because of that. Yeah, it's because we are so partial, because we're interested in our little bit and nothing else, that we end up confused, that we end up ignoring things that could be very important, could maybe contribute to our world if we would only allow them and see it correctly. But instead, we just aren't interested, because we are deeply partial beings. Okay? Because, and what does that mean? That means we haven't got the balance right between the Ratzon and the Seichel. Okay? That what matters here is to get that Ratzon Seichel balance correct, in order that we won't miss some of those other perspectives that might help contribute to the grander whole. Okay? And where he obviously now departs from Nietzsche quite some way, okay, if you go just to the bottom of that, where it gets a little more, l'chol eile habga'im, yeah, sha'olam kulo, v'anachnu bi'ichud, sovlim mehem. Okay, all these problems that the world and us individuals, you know, that we all suffer from, kru'im ha'tzadikim yachdei ha'ichudim ha'sichliim v'haratzoniim l'taken. It's the tzadikim who are able, who are miyachdei ha'yichudim, they're able to kind of, you know, bring together, they unify this underlying unity that is, again, ha'sichliim v'haratzoniim, yeah, the intellectual and the willful, the effective. That will lead to tikkun. Okay, the tikkun is something that can be effected by those tzadikim, yeah, those who are able to understand the partiality of knowledge and are broad enough and able enough to actually therefore maybe deal with some of the things that those kind of, you know, us mere ordinary mortals are maybe scared of. Okay, maybe scared of. Alright, or maybe just don't have the ability to bring into our orbit. Okay, which is very un-Nietzschean. Okay, Nietzsche doesn't think there is any unity. He just thinks there are lots of partial perspectives and, you know, that's an end of it. But within Rav Kook's sphere, he totally agrees with Nietzsche on what knowledge is like. The difference is that he believes that ultimately there is some underlying grand unity to the system, and it's our inability to perceive that, given our partiality, that we need to overcome. Okay, so he agrees there is perspective, there are all these different perspectives. But what Rav Kook is searching for is how to unify them. Okay? That's very difficult. Okay? That's not easy, especially, I mean, we haven't got kind of very much time, but on the back, the final sheet's just a quote from Orot HaTshuva. And here in Orot HaTshuva, kind of, and this is, you know, it so happens I was having to write something on Orot HaTshuva, so it's something that I was kind of, it was right there in front of me, this particular source. You could find numerous other sources that say the same in Rav Kook, okay? Because what's interesting is this cuts both ways, okay? What I've been trying to say today is, the religion-science conflict isn't about content. It's not about science says A, religion says B, they contradict and that's a problem. Yeah? Sometimes it might be a problem, not denying it can be. Yeah? But on the whole, if science says A and it's good science, it's proper science, yeah, and it's something that we use and rely on, then likelihood is either when religion says B it didn't mean B, it meant A, or it was talking about something else altogether. That's not the conflict. The conflict is the elimination of perspectives that do not share that scientific approach of pure seichel without Ratzon. Okay? And even science, according to Nietzsche, kind of his point is, even science is actually seichel with Ratzon. Your Ratzon there is for scientific knowledge, and that's what's directing the seichel. So yeah, everything's seichel and Ratzon, and they don't get that. They think we're pure seichel, everybody else is doing all this Ratzon stuff. No, no, no. They're doing exactly the same accommodation as everybody else, is the claim. Okay? So our religion and science come up with a very different type of conflict. And what it does, and what I've argued it does, is open up the possibility for you to talk entirely rationally about religious perspectives. Yeah? This is just, you know, this is like, so you do ruts on circles, so do we. And I know you don't like ours, but that's because unless you enter into it, you're never going to be able to recognise what it gives you. I understand that you don't understand, that you, Mr. Scientist who takes it, can't understand it. But that's obvious. It's not about pure seichel. You're looking there kind of calculating. How does that work? That's not what it's about. You've got to get the ratzon part working in tandem with the seichel in order to even appreciate what we're talking about. Okay, that's what we're saying. But it does cut both ways. Because, according to Rav Kook at least, okay, have a look finally here. I haven't got much time, so I'm just looking at which bits are the best bits to look at. Let's start at the very top. Okay? Mitzaradim shonim tavo v'titgale hatshuva. Okay? That, you know, very, various different dimensions kind of that will be revealed that make up perfect tshuva. Yeah? Echad miyuchad mitzadeha eile yehiye hatsa'ar aha elbon shene'elav haruach hagadol ha'atzor b'chol ma שאין חילונו אבותינו, שאין שיעור לעוזו וכבודו. Okay? But one of the special, yeah, מיוחד, one of the special dimensions within this kind of grand תשובה will be what? הצער על העלבון שנעלב הרוח הגדול הצער בכל מה שאין חילונו אבותינו. Will be to do with the distress, the shame, the kind of, basically, the critique of religion, of, you know, of our ancestral heritage, she'ein shi'ur le'uzo chvodo, yeah, which is kind of incomparable in terms of actual cover. One of the main drivers of this ultimate tikkun, this ultimate tikkun being for him, of course, this knowledge of the unity that underlies everything, is actually going to be the critique of our most important and most deeply held beliefs. It's going to be the critique of our religion. Okay, that's going to be one of the drivers. Very interesting. Okay, and again, this is, you know, anybody who knows Rav Kook knows that this is kind of a theme in his thought. Okay, that what appears to be heresy, atheism, actually have an important role to play. And the important role it has to play is in making us understand what we're doing wrong and to fix up our own version of religion. Okay, it's very interesting that one of the, if you like, implications of this is, and something he says actually kind of towards the end here, yeah, so that's a part of it, yeah, but it actually a bit earlier, Kolele. Okay, if you go to the, it's about two-thirds of the way down the first paragraph, after there's a little kind of dash, yeah? All right, so he's talking about kind of, you know, all these kind of these unified noi. Kol eile yulduv yitgalu az b'chativa achat, asher tamcham strichim anu al yedei hachsharot halavavot l'ora shel Torah ha'amiti ha'pnimi, razei Torah, asher opi ha'ashpa'ot sheshpiu al eile asher davku bahem b'lo ha'hechshe ha'ra'oi, Kol kach ravu hamanakrim otam umalivim bahem. Okay? So what is he saying there? All of this kind of, all this knowledge, the knowledge of the true Razei Torah, okay, that we have all the hachsharot, we have the preparation for it, yeah? But it's dafka with that, that when we try and teach that to people where he says, belo ha'echshe ha'ravi, people who don't have the correct preparation for it, then kolkach ravu hamanachrim otam hamalivim bahem. Yeah, that just increases the agitation, increases the critique. Okay? Very interesting. If it's not about pure reason, yeah, then, so to speak, kiruv becomes a lot more difficult. Yeah? Because I can't teach somebody who is opposed to what I'm teaching from the perspective of pure rationality, say, look, if you're a rational person, you'll understand, you'll do this, and you'll keep shut, yeah, or whatever it is. Because it's not about that. It's about seichel and ratzon. And what he's saying is, therefore, we have to approach people who differ with us in a way that takes this into account. Now, on the one hand, this is good for us, because I can say to Mr. Scientist, look, I understand why you don't get religion, but that's kind of because you're cutting yourself off from it by not understanding how knowledge works. Yeah? But in the same way, as soon as we then do understand how knowledge works, it means we have to be very careful in how we present our own version of things to people who don't accept it. Because it's not just like showing them a scientific proof. It's about Seichel and Ratzel. And all of a sudden, therefore, we have to think about that, take that into account. And that's part of his kind of, you know, key idea, that therefore, as long as there isn't unity in the world, yeah, as long as there isn't that unity, it doesn't only mean that other people, it means we're doing something wrong. Okay, it means we're doing something wrong. One of the most interesting things about Rav Kook, and one of the implications of this whole kind of version of what it is to know, is that whereas without question, okay, that, you know, to be shomei mitzvot, etc., for Rav Kook is the right direction to be going in. Okay, that's without question. But the particular way in which we do it, the particular Torah that is not the, what did he call it later on? She'or Torah pnimit hata'un ramamot ukdusha atzmit. Okay, there towards the bottom. Okay, the inner Torah, this higher Torah. Okay, that's something that we're not quite there yet. Okay, that we have to understand, we can't sit here smug and self-satisfied that we've got all the answers and everybody else is just like hopeless. No. Okay, we don't have all the answers either. Right, for as long as there's disunity, it means that we're doing something, whether it's what we're actually doing or whether it's how we're approaching people, there's something we've got wrong. And in order to bring about this grand tikkun, we need to think about that as well. So it's interesting. Okay, the religion-science conflict revisited opens up a realm for the religious. Yeah, a realm for the religious that you can actually kind of get to philosophically. Okay, you can argue why it is that this scientific notion of knowledge is actually mistaken and problematic. Yeah, and we can stand on our own two feet. At the same time, it also raises questions as to how exactly we should be approaching kind of our very own version of Judaism and those who don't share it. Okay, and that's quite a challenge, and a challenge that Rav Kook thinks is something that only when we get the Ratzon Seichel thing in tune, as great Tzadikim might, okay, that maybe we'll be able to solve that. Thank you all for coming out on a Sunday morning and listening. It's been a pleasure. Up to a point, I suppose it is, although, because of the very material you're working on, it plays in to something that can, that moves it away slightly from that pure science type of notion.